Okay, today is Saturday, June the 12th, I believe, 1993, and my name is Rick Bradley, and I'm in Duncanville, Texas, with Bob Moncrief. Bob, first thing I want to ask you about is how'd you get started playing baseball as a very, very small, as a young man?
Well, I played American Legion baseball, and of course, and my dad, there was six of us boys, five of us living, and him and my oldest brother had a baseball team. Then I played American Legion ball. Then when I got out of high school, these companies kept giving me jobs to play, and that's the only way I had to eat or sleep, was take those jobs. And I finally wound up in Texas, and with Kraft, in Denison, Texas. That was the home of Rogers Hornsby, and so they got me a contract with the St. Louis Browns, and they sent me to San Antonio.
Who was the scout that, who was the first scout that maybe approached you, and who was the scout that eventually signed you?
I tell you, I can't remember names very well anymore. Mm-hmm. And one time I worked out with a Cardinals scout. St. Louis Cardinals. I saw him in St. Louis later. He said, "Well, we all make mistakes, Bob." But he didn't think I had it. And let's see, Tex Covington was a brother-in-law of Roger Hornsby. Now, he's the one that signed me to a contract.
And that year would have been?
1934.
What did your family think about you picking baseball as a career? This was the throes of the
Depression. Well, back then, anything to make a living. That was the thing about it. God, it was my family. Sometimes it was as high as 13 or 14 in my family. And back then, you didn't send the old people down to a home somewhere. You kept them. And we had a blind aunt that stayed with us for quite a while. And then there's six boys and six girls in our family, and five girls and five boys that was living. It was 10. And then my father and mother was 12, and this blind aunt was 13.
Sounds like quite a household.
Yeah, in a four-room house. And whenever I was playing baseball, of course, I played in the Texas League, and my mother and father and them lived in Oklahoma. They could get the Oklahoma City game and the Tulsa games and get in the Fort Worth and Dallas games. They had a big radio that was about, probably about 4 foot high and about 3 or 4 foot wide. And I bet it weighed as much as your car almost, full of batteries. Now, of course, I didn't know, but the girls, my sisters, told me that my mother used to listen to the ball games, and as long as I was ahead, mm-hmm. she'd sit up and listen. But if I got behind, she'd go to bed. Yeah, she wouldn't listen.
Now, what positions did you play while you were growing up? Were you always a pitcher, or did you play somewhere
else?
Well,
I played first base also, and I caught some in high school. Mm-hmm. If we run out of catchers, I was dumb enough to get behind the home plate.
Basically played every day then, huh?
Well, I played every game in high school, unless I was sick or hurt or something.
Mm-hmm. Anything about your minor league career that you want to talk about? Anything from Paris or Palestine or San Antonio or Hollywood?
Well, I won 15 ball games in a row at Palestine, and I won the Most Valuable Player Award in the Texas League in 1940. And that was the year my son was born, and I had a man come out and check my garage door. He did some work on it, my automatic door. And he said, "Well, I'm going home and get a bite to eat." He said, "I have a new baby." I said, "If it's any of my business, how much did that baby cost you?" He said, $3,600. And I got a check for $100 when I won the Most Valuable Player Award. And, of course, I have a scroll that's back there in my den, in my TV room. And we paid for that boy with that $100 bill. And we had the best, supposedly, the best doctor in San Antonio to look after my wife.
That's quite a difference.
Yeah, $100 from $3,600.
Boy, just want to backtrack just a little bit about your first day. Eric played with the Browns, a little bit in 37, a little bit in 39, but your very first day that you played in the major
leagues.
Well,
it was in Chicago, and it was the first time that I pitched any for the Browns, and I didn't do too good. And then in 1939, I started a ball game, I believe it was 39, against Detroit. And I'll never forget, the first pitch to Greenberg, he hit that ball 40 miles, but it was about a mile foul. Mm. And the next pitch was right down the middle, and he hit a little ground ball to shortstop. And so that's the way it went. They used to tell me, pitch Greenberg outside. I said, you don't pay me enough money to pitch him outside. Because he'd already broke Ostermuller's jaw and tore somebody's leg off. Mm-hmm. I said, you don't pay me enough money to pitch him outside. And, but Hank was an awfully nice guy.
Mm-hmm. So 1940, you make the most valuable player in the Texas League. And uh-huh. Then St. Louis, they had already, I guess, because you've been up and down, owned your rights. Uh-huh. Now 1941, you come up for good.
Yeah, and I think if they could have auctioned me out anymore, they would have. Because I'll never forget the first ball game I got in up there, we were playing the Yankees. Remember Charlie Keller?
Mm-hmm. King Kong Keller.
Well, the bases were loaded, and they brought me in, what was his name, the manager? Fred
Haney.
Yeah. So they brought me in from the bullpen, and Keller was a hitter, and he told me, of course, a short right field wall in St. Louis, and he told me, he said, now throw him fastballs outside, keep him off that wall. And I kept him off that wall because he hit that ball about 440 feet into the center field seats with the bases loaded. And I came in, and he said, well, at least you followed orders. He didn't hit the fence.
He kept off the wall. How were you treated when you came up in 41 and you, or even in 37 or when you made your debut? Yeah. Were the guys nice to you, or was it kind of like here's this young guy showing up trying to take my job?
They were all nice to me. They were all very good. You had Harlan Cliff and Alan Strange and George McQuinn.
Go ahead and tell me that story again about George that you told me.
George was a kind of a guy, he never said a word, and whenever he played first base, and all you could hear him was, come on Bob, real low, you could barely hear him. So I got the bases loaded in Boston, and Williams come up to hit, and I heard somebody yell, time, and I looked around, and it was McQuinn coming in, and I thought, well, now what does he want? And he walked up to me and he says, my name is George. I cannot tell a lie. You're in a hell of a jam. I think Williams almost took him in the right field.
I like that story. Yeah. Well, I want to kind of get this moving so I can kind of get everything in. I want to go from 41 right to 1944, the Browns. I want to ask you, I know the Browns, they started off 9-0.
Yeah.
And
I wasn't even there the first 8 ball games.
Okay.
I think I joined them in Chicago, and they won the first game. And I think I got beat the second game 4-3. I just joined the boss club. I go to show you how much spring training means.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was in the shipyard in Texas, down at Houston, Texas. And I left, and I went up there, and they had won 8 or 9. They won 9 in a row, didn't they?
Yeah, to start the year.
Yeah, well, they won 9, and I don't remember. I think we got beat a doubleheader that day. I think somebody got beat the first game, and I got beat the second game.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you another thing, funny thing that happened in Chicago. Remember Roy Cullenbine?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Roy was playing left field for us. Now, Judge Landis would come out to the ballpark, and he'd sit in that front seat, and he would sit with his hands on the rail, and he'd have that old straw hat on, and you couldn't tell where he was looking or what he was doing. So I've got him beat by about 4-1. Columbine's in left field. Now, where we stayed at the Del Prado Hotel, I think it was Del Prado, and a bar right down the street, they had a cocktail hour starting at 5 o'clock. So I walk a man, and I get two balls and no strikes on the next guy. And Columbine, you know how people are stomping their feet and things get real quiet. And just about time it got quiet, Columbine said, "Come on, you big so-and-so, get him out. We're going to miss the cocktail hour." And I looked over to see if Landis heard. He didn't say anything.
Landis was a tough guy, huh?
Yeah, I was rooming with Don Hefner, and about 7:30, 8 o'clock one morning, the telephone rang, and I hear Don saying, "Yes, sir, yes, sir." He hung up, and he said, "I wonder what..." Now, of course, everybody called him the old man, and unless it was to his face, then it was Judge Landis. He said, "I wonder what the old man wants with me." He said, "That was so-and-so, he had a male secretary at that time, I forget his name now." But Don, had played in New York, and there was some prize fighter that made quite a name on an island over in the Pacific, and he had come back. And Don had known him in New York, and he came up behind our dugout in Chicago, and Don was talking to him. So when he goes down to see Judge Landis, Landis asked him, said, "Who was that you was talking to yesterday?" He was standing up behind the dugout, and you was standing on the steps. And Don said, "Oh, that was so..." I forget the name of the prize fighter now, but he was champion at one time. And the old man said, "Yeah, Mr. Hefner?" He always called the ball players Mr. He said, "Mr. Hefner, don't you know that whenever he goes to church or the synagogue or where the hell he ever goes on a Sunday, he's not praying to God. He's trying to figure out some way of beating you out of a dollar." He said, "If I catch you talking to him one more time, you'll be suspended. That's all."
Ruled with an iron fist, huh?
Yeah, oh, God, I tell you. Iron fist. I tell you, what he said went, too.
Even though, the Browns are off 9-0, and this wasn't expected, I'm guessing. I mean, the Browns certainly weren't favored to win the pennant, I don't think, in 1954.
No.
What was the difference?
I'll tell you, we would have won in 45 if we didn't have Pete Gray.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Pete, I don't want you to get me wrong. Pete Gray was he had one arm,
right.
And he was a heck of a center fielder. I just assumed for him to be in center field to catch a ball as anybody I know of. But he had to throw that glove up and then catch the ball and then throw. I believe his right arm was off. And you could hear the coach on first base telling a runner, "Now, if that ball is hit in the center field on the ground, don't you even look. You go to third." Because he had to toss that ball, his glove and ball, and then catch the ball and then throw. So they just take the extra base all the time. And, of course, everybody wanted to see Pete Gray, and they played him. But he was a good ball player, but you know he wasn't going to hit much.
Yeah.
And they didn't just take an extra base on him just like if he wasn't out there.
It's pretty amazing. I know in 45, I think he wound up hitting .218 for the year. But when you consider just one arm, he's pretty amazing.
Yes, sir. I've seen him hit that screen in right field in St. Louis, in that old ballpark, in old Sportsman Park. He was an amazing guy.
What was the difference between the fan support for the Cardinals and the fan support for the Browns? Because I know even though the Browns eventually go on and win the pennant, they finished last in the American League in attendance. What was the...
Yeah, but we outdrew the Cardinals. That's the funny part about it. Everybody wanted to see the Browns win. Because the Cardinals had won so many times. But if I'm not mistaken, we outdrew the Cardinals that year. I think we drew about 600,000, and the Cardinals drew a little over 500,000.
Mm-hmm.
A little different these days, isn't it?
Yeah, a little different these days. So, well, just a couple more things about 1944. That was the year that you made the All-Star team.
Yeah.
How did they pick the guys for the All-Star game? And then tell me about your
well,
inning and the third.
The managers picked the pitchers, I believe, just like they do now.
Mm-hmm.
And me and Stevens and George McQuinn went from the Browns. And so what did I pitch? I pitched one inning, I know.
Inning and a third.
Inning
one
and
hit,
third.
One strikeout.
Yeah, I'll tell you that. I'll tell you one thing. Before the game, our team, the American League, was hitting balls out of that ballpark like flies.
Yeah.
And Tex Houston, I believe, started that ball game. And that Tex was throwing hard. It sounded like somebody stacking lumber. And those National Leaguers just wore him out. He didn't get anybody out. And we didn't hit any balls out of the ballpark either.
No, it was a 7-1 loss, as I recall.
Yeah.
Was there any sort of bonus or anything involved for you for making the All-Star team, or was it just
no,
extra money?
No extra money, no nothing.
Not like now.
Uh-uh.
These guys make the All-Star team now, $25,000, $50,000. All right, let's go to the end of the season and the sweeping the Yankees to clinch the pennant, that three-game series.
Jakuki pitched the last ball game. And now Chet Labs hit two home runs. Of course, he always got credit for that, but Vern Stevens also hit one into the right center field bleachers. I mean, in there. And Jakuki pitched a heck of a ball game. Of course, you know they didn't have Keller or DiMaggio or Hendricks and all.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it took me. I used to go into Yankee Stadium and I'd pitch a 4 or 5 hit ball game, and I'd get beat 3-1, 4-1, 4-2. And I never will forget one ball game. Now, Rizzuto, the right-hand hitter, he hit the ball down. I threw a fastball by him, and he hit the ball down the right field line and just into the seats. It was 298, I believe, down there.
Yeah,
it was 301 to left field. And Red Rolfe, the third baseman, he hit one just exactly like that. He's hitting the left-hand hitter down the left field line. And both of them had a man on. And so I get beat 4-1, and I pitch about a 4 or 5 hit ball game. And so my wife was in the hospital, and I'm pitching against the Yankees in St. Louis. And my son, of course, he was a little tired. He was, I guess, 3 or 4 years old. And he kept asking me all day, he said, "We're going to beat them Yankees, ain't we, Dad?" I said, "Yeah, we're going to beat them." So Harry Rackeen's wife, I was telling you, that Vera and I went to high school together. She, I tried to, there was a bunch of girls to stand at the hotel. And I had met one or two of them because I had breakfast. You couldn't get into breakfast unless you sit down at the table with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them, I said, they were all working at the small arms plant. So I went to one of them and I said, "Listen, I need a babysitter. My wife's in the hospital." She said, "Good." I said, "Would you sit with the baby tonight?" She said, "Oh yeah." She said, "What time you want me to come up there?" I said, "Well, I got to be at the ballpark at 5:00. She says, "You really have a baby, don't you?" And, you know, there was two of them. As long as I was the baby, they were going to sit. So Harry Breckin's wife, she told me, she said, "Bob, I guess her and a left-hand pitcher who was in the service by the name of Schmidt, they took care of my son, so this night that I'm pitching against the Yankees, I go out and so Vera brings him to the ballpark. And after the ball game, I meet him outside and I ask her, I said, "Did he enjoy the ball game? I beat him 8-0. I said, "Did he enjoy the ball game?" She said, "I guess so. He went to sleep before it started and he's still asleep."
So the Browns clinched the pennant, which is at the time is, I'm guessing, unthinkable, certainly at the beginning of the season.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, we had a good balanced ball club and had a pretty good fielding ball club. And all the stars were in the service.
Yeah.
And so...
things just worked out that way.
Yeah, yeah. I know the Yankees, they had, instead of Hendricks playing right field, they had a little hitter by the name of Bud Matheny.
Mm-hmm.
And Bud hit about 240, and he hit 239 of that off of me. He little left-hand hitter. And so he was there, so Mancuso's catching, and I told Mancuso, I said, let's start him off with a slider. I throw a pretty good slider, but it hurt my elbow, and I didn't throw it much. So the first pitch, I threw him a slider, and he hit that ball in the upper deck in Yankee Stadium about 10-foot foul. So Mancuso walked out, and he kind of grinned. He said, now why you want to throw him? I said, another slider. You know, he hit the easiest ground ball to second baseman, and he didn't get a base hit off of me from then on.
Really?
Yeah.
Would you throw nothing but sliders after that, or what?
Well, I don't remember what I, what I threw him, but he didn't get any more base hits off of me.
They said the Bronx had a pretty good fielding team. Then what happened in the World Series? Because they made 10 errors in 5 games.
Yeah, and well, I think we sent 8 or 9 pinch hitters to the plate, and every one of them struck out.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, like I tell everybody else, you know, we shouldn't have been in the same ballpark with the Cardinals. Mm. My God, the ball clubs that they had and the pitching they had. We shouldn't have been in the same ballpark, although we win 2 ball games.
And really, if they didn't make the 4 errors in the second game, theoretically, you could be up 3-0.
Oh, yeah. And but they had a good ball club. Good ball club. I think Johnny Hoffman's still there. And they had Moore in center field, Kurowski, Marion. As Chris used to say, he catches balls at 5 already. I tell you, that Trish was, of course, I was a good friend. Dizzy Dean was a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to tell me about Trish. So he said, if we'd have listened to Trish, we never would have won a ball game. And I believe him. Now then, since I played for Trish, mm-hmm. I believe him. And we were having a meeting, and we were playing the Cardinals. I was with the Cubs at this time. And Frisch's legs were short, and they wouldn't even touch the floor. He's sitting on a trunk, and he's kicking that trunk, and he's going down the line. You pitch him this way, and if he gets in the base hits, I'll take responsibility for it. So and so, you pitch him this way, and they come to Musial, he'd say Musial, and then he wouldn't say anything. He'd go to the next hitter. So when he get through, somebody said, Frisch, how about Musial? He said, I don't take any credit for him. he was a dilly, that fish. And he didn't want you throwing kind of fastballs. So I'm pitching one day. And I threw kind of a fastball. I had him all set up for a fastball, I thought, and I hit him. Of course, in that ballpark in Chicago, Cubs Wrigley Field, I hit Kiner about that far from the fist, and that ball just got into the seats. Well, I came in, and that fish called me everything but a ball player. If you throw him another fastball, it's going to cost you $100. So I threw him 2 curveballs after that. He came up to hit twice, and I threw him a curveball, 1 curveball, and he hit that apartment house across the street over them bleachers. So in the meantime, Frisch had gotten run out of the ball game, and he's sitting behind the dugout with a piece of tape over his mouth. I can still hear Dizzy Dean talk about that, with a piece of tape across his mouth. And I walked up, and I was going to the clubhouse. They took me out, and somebody relieved me. And I walked up, and I said, well, he hit one of mine and one of yours. And he hit yours twice as far as he hit mine. But he did. He every time we'd play Pittsburgh, we'd have to go on a road trip because those apartment hadn't the left field bleachers and that apartment houses across the street was torn up, kind of tearing them all up.
Well, I want to skip ahead just a little bit then to late in 47, November 1947, you went to the Indians.
Yeah, well, that...
in a trade.
Yeah, that... in 48, I tell you, I was off to a good year until... what's the guy from Philadelphia? Good God, I don't think I'd ever forget his name. Because I don't remember too much anymore. Hit me on the elbow with a line drive. I'll never forget, I had pitched two ball games in a row. I had five wins and one loss, I think. And I pitched to, I hadn't walked anybody. And I didn't want to go to 3-2. I hate to go 3-2 on a hitter. So Hank Majeski.
Yeah.
He was hitting. And I made a pitch to him, and I knew the ball was going to be just off the plate outside a little bit. And I thought, oh, God, I took my eye off that ball. And the next thing I know, I look up, and that ball's right here, and I go this way. And ball hit me. It felt like he just, you know, thumped me.
Mm-hmm.
And I turned to see where Dobie was in center field, and Dobie hadn't moved. So I looked around this way, and Boudreaux caught that ball in foul territory behind third base. Well, until I quit baseball, my fingers would feel like a ice cubes.
Really?
And the circulation, and there wasn't anything, but it hit me more solid than I thought it did. Boudreaux and Garden. Of course, we had a good ball club in 48. And DiMaggio would come up to hit, and they'd come in, they'd say, pitch him outside. Well, I didn't want to pitch him outside, but I did. And he'd hit balls back by me, and here's Boudreaux or Garden, one standing on second base. You know, if he did, they couldn't play in the seats, but if it was ground ball, they'd be standing on second base, and they'd throw him out at first base.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I think he hit three home runs one day. I think we had the biggest crowd that they ever had in Cleveland, 80-something thousand, doubleheader. And he had three home runs. He hit one off of me. And it seemed like he hit two off of Feller. It seemed like Feller started the game or somebody. Anyway, Nimmo or somebody. And quite a ball player. I'd hate to have to choose between him and Mantle and
Williams?
Well, no. Willie Mays. Oh,
Willie Mays, I see.
Yeah.
For center fielder.
It's for center field. I guess I'd take the big Dago, though. I'll tell you. But Mantle, and I was with the Yankees in 51, just about long enough to get a cup of coffee. I was in spring training with them. And that was Mantle's first year, and they finally sent him down to Kansas City with me. And you knew somebody was going to have to move over for him. So within 1 to 2 years, somebody was going to have to move over. Well, he was fortunate enough that DiMaggio retired that year. And from then on, he took about 0 for 20, 21 in Kansas City. But he hit a couple of balls, not in Kansas City, but on the road that you wouldn't believe. He hit a ball in Toledo. Now, Toledo's ballpark was about 340 something to the right field fence, and then they had the lights. Then they had a four-lane boulevard the other side of the fence, and then there was apartment houses, two-story apartment houses. The first time up, he hit right-handed, and he hit a home run to left field. And he hit a ball to right field off of this guy. Now, I can't think of his name. He went to the Tigers as a pitcher from then on. He was a pretty good pitcher. But anyway, the right fielder, and he went to the Tigers later on too. And the right fielder, he ran back, and he looked up, So when he came in, he come in the front of our dugout, and he says, look, he says, I didn't run back expecting to catch that ball. I just wanted to see where it was going. He says, you're not going to believe me whenever I tell you. He said, that ball hit on top of that second apartment house. And from the fence, it had a four-lane road and then another two-story apartment house.
Wow.
And I was sitting at the table. I lived over on Marsalis. When he hit that ball in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and I told my wife, I said, this is a blueprint. Nobody can hit a ball that far. And it said where he hit it and all. I said, that old park in Washington, D.C. I said, that's a misprint, but I guess it wasn't.
That's what they say. He hit it over the scoreboard, I guess, right? 565 feet is what they mm-hmm. credit him with. Was there any hard feelings from St. Louis when you were traded from St. Louis to Cleveland?
No.
Or you think yourself, hey, I'm going from a not a real good ball club to a one that's got a chance of winning the pennant again?
Oh, yeah. I was glad to get out of St. Louis because we never had a good ball club.
Was it a shoestring type operation?
Yeah, they had to sell ball players in order to meet the payroll.
Oh,
the first year I was up there, I won 13 ball games. Now, this is before the big guys went to the service. 1941. And we are in Chicago, and Luke Applin, one of the greatest guys, I don't know if you ever met him or not, but he's one of the greatest guys you've ever seen, and also a good shortstop. So I'm pitching that day, and it had about a week, 10 days to go. So I walked down, you had to walk through the Chicago dugout to get to the visitor's dugout. And Luke was sitting there, and he was boning on the bat. So he was from Atlanta, down around Atlanta. He said, well, kid, I see by the local blade you're it today. I said, yeah, Luke. He said, look, he said, Jim told me I could go home. Jimmy Dykes was the manager. He said, Jim told me I could go home if I wanted to. But he says, now, I want to hit 300. He said, they got me hitting 301, but he said, if they made one mistake somewhere in there, he said, I'd hate to go home and wind up hitting 299.99.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'll tell you what, you give me a base hit the first time up, and I'll get thrown out on the first pitch. I said, okay. So I'll go to the catcher, and I go to Harlan Cliff, the third baseman. And I told Luke, I said, just bunt the ball. Just bunt it fair. Be sure it's fair. And that's all I ask, and you'll get a base hit. So I went to the catcher and I went to Cliff and I told him about it. So the first pitch, I just laid the ball in there and he bunted the ball down the third baseline. Well, I stood on the mound and Cliff, he took his time and the catcher didn't come out. So he gets a base hit, he's on first. So the next pitch, he's going to second base and he's looking back laughing. And then if a catcher didn't throw the ball into center field. And so he slid in the second, and he sat there until Judnick got the ball about 100 feet behind second base.
Mm-hmm.
And he jumped up and he started to third, and he's looking back at Judnick, you know, throw me out, throw me out. Well, Judnick throws the ball into the White Sox dugout, and it's an automatic run. But if I'm not mistaken, I got beat 5-3. That run mm-hmm. didn't have anything to do with it. I think I got beat either 4-2 or 5-3. Yeah. It was anyway. I got beaten by 2 runs.
Yeah, but he was mad at his word anyway. Huh?
Yeah, oh yeah. And now I won 13 ball games. We couldn't get a man out when he was trying to get out. Honest to God, we couldn't.
Back to 1948 for one thing, and then of course we want to talk about the playoff game and the World Series, but. What happened in the bullpen there at Fenway when Russ Christopher popped you with the baseball?
Well, I was just standing watching the ball game, and Russ was warming up, and all of a sudden, I'm down on my knees. He hit me right here. It's a good thing it wasn't Feller.
Oh, I guess.
And he had thrown an underhanded curveball, and the catcher was like over here, and that ball and come, you know, wide, and the catcher missed it. But he hit me right up here in the temple. And they, of course, if it had been Feller that got hit, he'd have been out for a week. Mm-hmm. They'd have sent him to the hospital. But nobody even asked me how I felt. And it reminded me, when I was in Kansas City, and Madam was in Kansas City, we had an off day and we all went out to the lake. And there was about five or six guys in a boat left the bank, and Mantle was one of them, and the boat capsized. And they were throwing ropes and lifesavers out there, and here these scouts and the managers hollering, "Get Mantle, get Mantle, get Mantle."
The rest of them drowned.
Yeah.
So at the end of the year, the Indians lost two or three to the Tigers, and they wound up tying the Red Sox for first place, and now we've got this playoff game. What do you remember about the playoff game? And I know you played with Danny Gailhaus.
Yeah.
Were you surprised that McCarthy?
Yeah, I figured he'd start the left-hander. What was his name? He won 20 ball games that year. Of course,
they had Mel Parnell.
Mel Parnell. Yeah. And he had beat us a couple of times. And Gailhaus was a good pitcher. He just never did have any luck. I think Denny would just make some bad pitches every now and then, make the ball too good.
Mm-hmm.
But I never forget. I think Woodrow had two home runs.
Two home runs, right? And Keltner had a three-run shot.
Yeah. Well, Keltner getting on the train that night in Cleveland to go to Boston. Now, Keltner, the drunker he got, the longer his arms would get. He looked like an ape walking. And, oh, God, he was higher than a kite. Somebody said, "He'll never be able to play tomorrow." And somebody said, "Yeah, you watch him." Now, Keltner was, now, there's another guy I think ought to be in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
He made a good shortstop out of Boudreau, I'll tell you that, because he fielded everything to his left, and Boudreau would play on top of second base, or toward second base, and he'd field balls that no other shortstop would get to.
Yeah.
And, but Keltner was the one that made a good shortstop out, I mean, seemed to be a good shortstop. Now, Lou had good hands when he got to the ball. And Lou led the league that year, and I'll never forget, I was on second base, and somebody got a base hit. Lou got a base hit, and I missed third base. And so Lou was battling for the championship at that time. He wound up winning the batting championship. And I missed third base, and I was third out, so his base hit didn't count. Yeah,
you heard about that one?
Christ's sake, touch your bases.
I ask you a couple of things about 48 before you get to the World Series. What was it? Was there any difference playing for when Boudreau was playing in 48 with the Indians? He was player manager. Was there any difference between playing for Boudreau as player manager than just playing for dad and setting the dugout?
No. Now Lou done it. I thought Lou done a heck of a good job. And but of course he was out there on the field, and in fact he had an advantage in a way about changing pitchers. And of course the pinch hit for somebody, he was sitting on the bench when he'd do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think really Lou was a good manager. I liked Lou. Yeah, I tell you, the guy that helped him was McKechnie.
Mm-hmm. Bill McKechnie?
Yeah, he helped Lou a lot from the bench. Well, listen, let's wind this thing up.
Okay, I want to talk about, this is going to be my favorite part.
Yeah.
Bob, coming from Cleveland and only being 34 years old, I was born in 59, World Series in Cleveland is something I don't know anything about. So tell me about the 48 Series.
Well, I tell you, after if I'm not mistaken, Johnny Sain beat us the first game.
Mm-hmm.
Pickoff
play at second.
Yeah. And, of course, we all went and dug into the clubhouse, and everybody was laughing. They said, "Well, ain't no trouble. We're going to beat them. We know that." And so, which we did, and then Spahn started the next day, and I think somebody had told Spahn we were fastball hitting ball club because he was goosing the ball up there. And later on, he pitched a ball game against us, and he was firing that ball. He was really good. But mm-hmm. I think the game he started, somebody told him we were a fastball hitting balls club. And what did we win it in? Six?
Six games, yeah.
Yeah. And I tell you another thing that on that, after we won the pennant, no, the playoff game, Bill Veck sit on his suitcase in that railroad station, and he signed autographs, must have signed them for, God, I don't know how long. And Veck was a nice guy.
You enjoyed playing for him?
Yeah.
Treated the players well?
Oh, yeah. But he didn't like me much because, I got hurt. My yeah. right arm got hurt.
Yeah.
When I got hit on the elbow, I had really 5-1 at that time. Wound up at 5-4. Vic was all right. He was. He called me back then. You couldn't put anything in the contract. So the contract that I signed with Cleveland was $12,000. I believe it was $12,000. And he said, if we draw X number amount of people, I'll give you another $3,000. Well, of course, we drew more than any ball club had ever drawn up to yeah. that time. But he didn't say anything. And I'll tell you what kind of a guy he was. Gene Bearden, I know you know him. Back then, it was tough to buy an automobile. You couldn't buy a new car. So Gene, he had found this Ford agency off over there somewhere, so he came to me, and this was an off day, and it was payday. And we go over to this, and Gene was picking up this new Ford. And I was sitting on the outside of the office. It wasn't just a wall up about this high, and they were sitting inside, and I can hear this guy saying, now, Gene, don't take and sell this car, because I can sell this car for $700-$800 more than maybe $1,000 than I'm selling it to you for. But now, don't go and sell it. And Gene sat right there and promised him, of course, I had carried him over there, and we stopped at 3 or 4 places going back, him trying to sell that Ford. So, of course, Beck heard about it, and we go down to the stadium to pick up our checks. Beck was down there, and he called Gene in. He said, now, the people are pretty good to us here in Cleveland this year. He said, now, you tried to sell that Ford, and Gene said, well, I bought it, I paid for it, it's mine, I can sell it if I want to. And Beck picked up the telephone. I bought a Buick out there later on, and called, the name of that Buick place. But anyway, he asked that guy, he said, you got a new Buick? He said, yeah. He said, send it over here. He said, I'll buy it for you. So he bought Bearden a new Buick to keep him from selling it. And Gene took them both to California and sold them that car.
Terry, Bob, let me ask you three real quick ones. The three that I have here at the end. Was when your baseball career was over, I know after you're out of the big leagues, did you played in Pacific Coast League for
yep.
a while? After your playing days were over, was the adjustment from the playing days to not playing baseball, was that easy for you?
Well, yeah, it was. It didn't bother me any. I went right into selling Chevrolets. I made more money selling Chevrolets than I made in baseball anyway.
Okay, that's my next question.
Yeah.
What have you done between then and now? So let's go ahead and
well,
put them together.
I sold Chevrolets. I worked for one company for 24 years. And I retired in 60, I believe it was 63.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought this house in 76. But I believe it was 63 that I retired. I had to on account of my legs.
Mm-hmm.
And so since I quit selling automobiles, I haven't done anything but try to keep my health.
Mm-hmm. Well, last question is this. If there was one thing that you could go back and wish maybe it turned out different, or maybe one thing that you could go back and change at any time that you, during the time you played baseball, what would that be, if anything?
Well, I think I'd take better care of myself. And I tell you, when I was with the Yankees, of course they had Fred Sanford. He had been with the Browns too, and Casey had paid $100,000 for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Casey called me in to send me to Kansas City, he says, "That big fat ass Sanford," he said, he shouldn't be in the same ballpark with you, but I ain't going to send him to Kansas City. I ain't going to show Case up because I paid $100,000 for him." But I got a little cut out of the World Series, the Yankees World Series that year.
Oh, that was nice of
them. Oh, yeah. They were a nice bunch of guys over there. DiMaggio, and I never forget the story that Joe Page told me about Joe. When he first went to the Yankees, he was on second base. He said somebody hit a ball in between the outfielders. He rounded third base, and he's trotting, and he's looking back. He said, "Man," he said, "they couldn't have shot me out at home plate with a runner."